Okay, I'm loosened up now, children.
Wow!
Welcome to the Ugly Things Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Stacks. We do our best to keep to our regular schedule of at least 2 episodes per month, but right now I am buried with work, finishing up a new issue of Ugly Things, which will go to the printer in a couple of days. So, in lieu of a new episode, we're going to share some outtakes from one of our earlier episodes, an interview with Derv Gordon, the lead singer of The Equals. It was recorded in January 2023. Derv just completed a short West Coast US tour, and it was a real pleasure to see him and his wife Judith in San Diego. Our band The Loons opened the show, which was at the Kensington Club. Derv played a fantastic set of Equals hits and deep cuts, backed by the excellent band So What. Derv loves nothing better than to be on stage. He lights up the room like a searchlight when he sings, and the energy he gets back from the audience lights him up even more. It was wall-to-wall smiles, dancing, and singing along to all of those great songs. It was a great night, and I could tell it meant a lot to Derv to be back over here singing for the people. I hope you enjoy these interview excerpts. Be sure to check out our entire Derv Gordon episode if you haven't already.
Hello?
Derv, it's Mike Stacks.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm fine, actually.
Good. What's the weather like there?
Actually, today it's a bit damp, rainy. Not cold, but just that damp, overcast, really, all day.
Yeah.
Mind you, it's night now. It's dark now, anyway.
Right, of course, yeah. Well, great. I'm glad we could set this up.
Yeah, why not? Why not? It's always interesting reading your tales, and I admire you actually greatly as a musician and as a person, really.
Oh well, thank you, man. That means a lot coming from you.
You seem to enjoy what you do, and it's not all about money. And to me, that's really important, you know.
It is. It's the most important thing, I think. You know, it's. If you don't enjoy it, then, you know, it's not going to be good, I don't think.
I don't know. Sadly, there are people out there who seem to be doing quite well but not really enjoying it. Then they turn to other, you know, drugs and alcohol and all the rest of it. Yeah. It's sad, really.
Yeah.
But I think you're one of the good guys.
Well, thank you, Derv. So are you.
Thank you.
Well, you know, let's kind of just have a conversation and go through your story, see what happens, really.
Okay, yeah.
Let's start at the beginning.
You seem to be losing your English accent there. I mean, a touch of America there.
Oh, it's an ongoing battle, Derv. I've been.
It's infectious, isn't it?
Yeah. You want to be understood, so you start adjusting without even knowing it.
Yeah,
and I usually slip back into more of an English accent when I talk to people in England. So by the end of the conversation, I'll be completely English again.
Okay, I understand both anyway.
All right, good.
I have quite a few American relatives anyway. So
yeah, yeah. The world's getting smaller now. We're all going to be talking the same, in about 100 years probably.
I think so. With the internet and television, I think, yeah.
Yeah,
it doesn't seem odd anymore to hear a foreign accent, really.
Yeah, no, I mean, growing up in England, you know, if you just go to a different town, you'd be,
Yeah.
I remember, you know, my family, we moved to Yorkshire when I was about 13 or 14, and I could not understand a word they were saying for the first month. I'm like, oh my God, how am I going to get through this school, you know, with I can't understand what the people are saying. But, you know, I was talking with a Yorkshire accent within a couple of years.
it depends on where you live, really.
Yeah.
I once had a Scottish friend, and he was from Glasgow, from the Gorbals, I think it is, in Glasgow.
You know? Oh, yeah.
And it took me years to understand what he was saying. You know, most of the times I would just go, yeah, but I really didn't understand what he was saying. His accent was so thick.
Scottish.
Even though he was living in England, he still had a very thick Scottish accent.
Yeah, he must have gone through life with people just sort of looking at him and not understanding what he was saying.
Possibly. Well, because, you know, in London, people are not very, you know, acceptable to other people's accents, really. You know, if it sounds foreign, then they, you know, they sort of don't appreciate it, really. So I love accents, really. You know, I find them fascinating.
And tell me about, you know, you were talking about management, but early on you were involved with this guy called Lee Shepherd.
Yeah, that's right.
Tell us about Lee. I mean, what did he do to help the band in the early days?
Lee was very encouraging. He really believed in us. He was an actor, but wasn't very successful at that. But he was a very rich man. His family were very rich, and they owned a lot of property around the area where John lived. You know, a lot of the big houses around there was owned by his family.
Yeah.
So really what he just mainly did was just manage the property, and he'd get the odd acting part. But he also knew people in the BBC and in the theatre as well. And, you know, he introduced us to these people. He would take us to see plays. We even got us a gig in Glyndebourne Opera House as well.
Wow.
It's very strange, but, you know, they're interesting gig. And he got us our first television, really, which was Play School. And I don't know if you remember, if you knew what Play School is.
Oh, yeah, I remember Play School, yeah.
Kiddies program, yeah, on the BBC. So we did a week on it. We did 5 days on there, actually. And that was our first taste of television. And this was before we had a recording contract.
Were you playing your own songs, or were you doing, like, children's songs? Or?
We played a couple of our songs. Because there's one on YouTube, actually, I think, called Sunny Boy, with Eddie playing the harmonica and me playing the maraca. But we played some of ours, but we also had to do things like 10 Green Bottles on the Wall, which... You know, little nursery rhyme songs.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Wow.
And after doing that, you know, I thought, oh, wow, we're stars, you know. I went out of the house and thought people would start recognizing me. But nobody did. He also took us to Ready, Steady, Go as well to see how it was recorded. Because by the time we had a hit record, Ready, Steady, Go was off the air. It was Top of the Pops. And... The presenter of Ready, Steady, Go was a woman called Kathy McGowan.
Of course, yeah.
And he introduced her to her, and she would do gigs in these clubs. They're called the Witch Doctor Clubs. There was a chain of them, you know, and we would perform there on their shows. And he got us gigs, but the most interesting gig that we got was the All-Star Club, where a lot of the American performers would perform there. People like Wilson Pickett, Solomon Burke, and Rufus Thomas, and Carla Thomas, and a lot of the big American acts would perform there
on
Saturday night, and we would support them. So you learnt a lot from these people, how they perform, how they deal with an audience and so on. Also, what was great for me was my home was about a mile away from the Finsbury Park Astoria, which was later named the Rainbow, and all the big acts would perform there. And I had a friend, a couple of friends who worked there, and they would open the side door, and myself and Eddie and Lincoln and John would slide in and watch the shows.
Oh, great.
Of course, we didn't have the money to go and see all these shows. And after seeing Chuck Berry there, actually, Chuck Berry was the one that really made it for me. I thought, this is what I want to do.
Yeah.
The way he dealt with the audience, the way he performed, I thought, yeah, this is it. This is what I want to do. So a number of acts there. The Beatles, Johnny Kidd and the Pirates, you know, the Searchers, the Tremolos, the Who, you know, all for free.
Wow, great, yeah. And you're sort of watching and learning and what have you.
That's right. Because it's not like now where you've got YouTube, you can go on and you see all these different acts, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, the other thing I used, there was a woman called Winifred Atwell that played the piano. She was on a Saturday evening. Oh, my father liked it. I was like, it wasn't my type of music.
Winifred Atwell, I remember, yeah.
Yeah, punishing.
Yeah, I could see how Chuck Berry would blow your mind after Winifred Atwell.
But there was a great show on a radio show, it was called the BBC Light Radio then, before Radio 1.
Yeah.
And there was a disc jockey called Sam Costa, and he used to play all the latest American stuff, Elvis Presley and so on, you know. So that I used to love listening to that show on a Saturday afternoon. And also, we had a radio in the kitchen, a little transistor radio, and I would take it into my room, and under the blankets, I would listen to Radio Luxembourg. You know, yeah. They played some good stuff. Right? And there was a disc jockey on there that I met later on in life, a guy called Stuart Henry. He used to play my type of music, you know. It's my late man for me. I'm the guy who made her a star. We would sold my brand new. It took me a long time, really, to get used to traveling again on the road, being driven by someone, you know? There was always this little tension there whenever, you know, I got in the car and, you know, to go off.
Oh, sure.
We were working, you know, 6-7 nights a week, really. You know? There was a lot, you know, a lot of traveling involved. You start off with a tour that's supposed to be a 2-week tour, and it ended up to be a 6-week tour.
Right, and sometimes you were doing 2 or 3 shows in one day, right?
Yeah, and that as well. Yeah. And also, I missed the birth of my daughter, which was my first child, because we were on tour. We were in Germany on tour, and I couldn't get back in time for the birth. And believe me, Mike, it's not a pleasant experience. My parents were upset. My in-laws were upset. My wife was upset.
Oh, yeah.
I was upset.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Yeah. You miss that. They don't repeat it, you know.
I thought of what happened. So when Jude became pregnant with our second child, 3 years later, but our son, I coming close to birth time, I took 2 weeks off, you know, no gigs. I'm going to be at home. I need to be at home, you know, because I want to be at home, because he was going to be born at home, not in a hospital. Right? So I stayed home 2 weeks, and the last day was a Saturday. Meant to go off to Manchester to do a gig on that night. About 12 o'clock, Jude went, I think it's happening. I thought, oh, gosh, I've got a gig. But where we lived was in Hertfordshire, and it was sort of semi-rural. So the midwife had come earlier, and she said that she was going to be not in the area. The doctor, who was meant to attend the birth, he was at a wedding, but he had a telephone number, and if we could telephone him. So I telephoned, I rushed up to get the midwife, telephoned the doctor, but on the way to get the midwife, I had to drive to where she was, and the car was in the garage. Jumped in the car, and forgot to open the door, the garage door. Fortunately, it was a double door, a swing door. So when the car hit it, the doors just flew open. Didn't bother to stop to see if any damage or whatever. I took off and got hold of her, came back. The doctor came. And then shortly after the doctor came, Jude started to give birth. And then the group car turned up with the rest of the guys. They said, "What's happening?" I said, "Jude's giving birth." They said, "What? Oh, let's have a bet. What's it going to be, boy or girl?" I said, "Oh, it's definitely going to be a boy." But no, it's going to be a girl. And so while they're sitting out there in the drive, Jude is giving birth. I'm helping. Well, I think I'm helping. And my thought, oh, God, I hope this bed doesn't collapse. You know, there's all of us on this bed. I gave birth. Fine. You know, baby was all right. No problems. Right. Said, okay, I'll see you later, love. Off I went to do the gig.
Wow.
Fortunately, she had some relatives there as well, so she was okay. But,
you were there for that one.
Yeah. I actually partake in it, so, you know, I felt really proud of that.
Yeah, I bet. Wow.
I really bonded with my son then, you know. At one time, I was the only one who could feed him. He wouldn't take from anyone else. I was the only one, you know.
Ah, oh, that's really special, yeah.
Yeah. So there you are, you know, being on the road. I want to know, oh yeah, why is it you love this old? Oh yeah, why do you care for this old? Oh yeah, oh baby, my dad wasn't very encouraging. I mean, he thought I should go to university or college or whatever. Yeah. Music isn't, you know, a profession that you can live on, you know. But
right, of course.
Proved him wrong. My mum signed our contract.
I mean, your dad must have accepted it at some point. There you are, you know, driving these nice cars. And
I don't know. Apparently, I heard rumours that he used to show off at work, you know, my sons are in the equals. I don't know. He never come up to me and say, you know, Dirk, you know, great, you know, well done. Because we had a television, but I could, when we did Top of the Pops, we were always off somewhere doing a gig. So I never actually saw Top of the Pops in the 60s when we were doing it. Now, it was recorded on a Wednesday night, on Wednesday, and it was, went out on Thursday. And on that Thursday night, we would always be somewhere, you know, Manchester or Liverpool or someplace. Yeah. They never actually saw it. But my mother used to watch it. And she was very proud. She went around telling everyone, my sons are in the equals, you know, all her friends. But my father never really got any great encouragement from him, really. But he loved music, my father.
Yeah.
He loved jazz. He loved blues. He loved ska, blue beat, because he had a friend who used to bring all that stuff up from Jamaica before they were released in the UK.
Yeah.
And my mother was a big Jim Reeves fan. Every Sunday we had Jim Reeves. You know, it was like a religious thing. Yeah. But there was always music in the house, you know. Fortunately, my parents were music lovers, so we weren't sort of discouraged greatly, you know.
Yeah.
It's just my father didn't think it was a way to make a living or a profession.
Right. Yeah, no, a lot of people encounter that.
Yeah, well, it won't last long. you know.
Yeah.
Because, to be quite honest, pop music or rock music, what you call it, was not really respected, you know, in the 50s and 60s by the older generation.
No.
They thought it was just a fad. It would go away, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, they didn't think it was even real music. It was just some sort of novelty.
Yeah. That's right. But they were proven wrong, so.
That's for sure.
Fortunately.
Yes. 1, 2, 3, 4. Let's talk about the Eagles played in Zambia twice, right? 1970
yeah.
and 1971.
Oh, incredibly intense.
Please, let's talk about that.
Yeah, amazing crowds, people hanging from trees and walls. And actually, the president came to one gig as well. We did a performance for him as well. Yeah. But the odd thing is with Zambia at the time, all their groups were named after European or American groups, well, English or American groups, you know, they had Zambian Beatles and you know, the Zambian Rolling Stones and, you know, Searchers and so on. But the crowds were amazing. And to me, it was odd because to me, music came from Africa, you know, and here we are taking this stuff back there. I mean, you know, but they loved it. Yeah. Yeah.
Great experience. What was your experience as far as, were the audiences mixed, black and white? And
the audiences were mainly black.
Right.
Because there weren't many white people. The white people in Zambia at the time were people who were working there, like Australian people and some South African people, as well, white South Africans as well, and from what was then called Rhodesia as well. And they wouldn't offer us visas or work permit to perform in Rhodesia, which is now Zimbabwe, or South Africa. But we had fans who come over from there to Zambia to the concerts there. Because we played in the north of the country, in the center of the country, and in the south of the country. So we basically covered all of Zambia.
Yeah. And you were playing big venues, right?
Yeah. The idea of football stadium and stuff like that.
Wow.
And all the shows were sold out. And the sad thing is there were kids who weren't able to come in because they couldn't afford it, you know. It wasn't a lot, but they couldn't afford it. And we would pay for some of them to come into the venues as well.
Right. Right, so that's why they were in trees, right? Like outside the stadium,
yeah.
So they could see.
Oh, yeah, because most of them never seen a black person from another country. You know, so that was fascinating. And they knew all the songs as well, you know.
Yeah.
There's a number of songs in Zambia that were not released in other countries as well.
Right. But, of course, as you said, you weren't able to go to Rhodesia, South Africa, because, I mean, you represented everything that...
Well, in South Africa... It was against the law to have a photograph of a black of a mixed group, black and white group. So on their first album, The Unequaled Equals, which has got a photograph of the five of us, on the South African release, it's a black and white domino.
Wow.
That was a very clever move, actually.
Yeah, it was a statement, I guess. I don't know.
It was such a stupid law, but that's apartheid for you.
Yeah.
But later on, we released albums there where the photographs were on. I think in 1969, Equal Supreme, I think, was released there with the sleeve of the band, the photograph of the band.
Right. But probably having a mixed race group on stage in South Africa would have been out of the question at that time, right?
Yeah.
Well.
And the odd thing as well is that we actually performed in East Germany before the wall came down.
Right.
And they weren't supposed to know the songs, but they knew all the songs.
Oh, yeah. They found a way around that.
The night that, the day that the wall came down as well, you know, that was an interesting experience.
Oh, I bet.
Yeah, it was amazing. Truly amazing. Because it used to, going there, it used to be very difficult. You know, even if you just in transit, it was very difficult. You'd go in, and as you entered East Germany, your passport was taken away, and it would put in this, they put it in this sort of tube thing, and yeah, all the cars would be there lined up, and off it went. And about 4 to 5 minutes later or so, your passport would come back, and then you had to stick to the speed limit. If you didn't, you'd get in trouble. You weren't allowed to stop and talk to anyone. If you saw people working in the field or whatever, you weren't allowed to speak to them. The only time you could talk to someone there is if you went to a petrol station. That's the only place you could talk to an East German.
Yeah.
And then when you got to the other end, the same thing would happen again. Your passport would take and go through. You'd wait maybe an hour, checkpoint Charlie or whichever the checkpoint you're coming up. Then your passport would be given back again. But we did some shows on the border of East Germany and West Germany. And the people in East Germany were standing there watching the people in the West Germany at the concert.
Yeah.
But they couldn't communicate. They couldn't come over or whatever.
Yeah. Well,
it's a sad affair. But it was a great night seeing them coming over.
Right, right.
There was a big demand for bananas.
Yeah. About that.
Get bananas. Yeah. And they were given 100 marks as well. It was marks at the time by the West German government.
Well, I think I got everything I need for the podcast. I got this great producer, James, and he's a brilliant editor. So he's going to make us both sound really good, and we'll insert some music in there, and it'll be like a really really interesting and fun episode, I think.
I absolutely trust you. I know you will do. It will be brilliant.
Oh, yeah.
You've got an excellent following of people. People trust you. People love you. You know, I watch you. You know, I keep my eyes on you, Mike. You know.
Well, thanks. I try to do my best to be doing the right thing, and you know, and
I love the relationship you have with your wife as well. You know, it's similar to myself and Jude. You know, she's there. You know,
right. Yeah. Yeah, no. And if you've got someone by your side like that, you can accomplish so much. You know.
Well, the thing is, you can, if you accomplish something and you've got no one to share with, it doesn't really mean a lot.
Yeah.
In my eyes, you know. I love to share, you know. I love to share. I mean, one of the most disappointing things was that I did a gig in New York, and the day before the gig, Jude fell and broke her arm, so she couldn't make it to the gig.
Oh.
It was a good gig, but it just didn't feel right that she wasn't there, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, no, it's great when you have your partner with you.
It is.
And
it's great.
Share it with them.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I even forgive my daughter for being an ABBA fan, but what can I say?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Bring the whole family over.
No. I don't want them on my trail. They've got their own thing, doing their own thing.
Yeah, of course. All right, Dirk. Well, I'll let you get back to your Saturday.
Okay, Mike.
I got.
And give Angela my love and Philip.
I will do that, and please give
and
our love to Jude.
I do hope that we meet in 2023 this year.
That's near the top of my list of things I want to do, so let's see if we can make that happen.
Okay. Great. Well, you should check me out anytime, Mike. You're always welcome.
All right, great. Thanks, man. Appreciate it.
Okay, man.
All right. Have a great weekend.
And you, Mike. Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Butterfly,
red, white, and blue. You love flowers, and I love you. Like a rainbow.
The Ugly Things podcast was produced by James Archer and hosted by Mike Stacks. That's me. Ugly Things magazine is available at the very coolest record and bookstores and at uglythings.com. That's ugly-things.com, where you can also order back issues, vinyl, books and CDs, and read additional articles and reviews. Please subscribe to the podcast, leave a review, and spread the word. We would also appreciate it if you became a Patreon supporter. For a small monthly donation, Patreon members get exclusive access to all kinds of interesting bonus content. Your contribution will help us to keep bringing you the very best in 1960s beat, garage and psychedelic music, and lots more. I'd like to send out a personal thank you to our top Patreon supporters: Glenn Gibbs, Charlie Konisaka, Keith Patterson, Sophia Swartz, Dean Curtis, David Biasotti, David Jones, Michael Barbera, Chip Lyon, Rob Brannigan, Stephen Schmidt, J. Paul Reiger, Derek Davidson, and Craig Easton. Thank you, all of you, for your support, and thank you for listening.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more Fantasy Points.